Hi, I'm Clement Liu. Welcome to Season 4 of Just Sustainability. I'm going to skip ahead a bit to begin this episode. At the end of the previous episode, we left off with Marceline Mosher and I talking about explanatory journalism. Marceline mentioning explanatory journalism, let me go on an extended tangent about why I like TikTok, which I'm cutting because nobody is listening to this podcast to learn about my social media preferences. However, me mentioning TikTok led Marceline to reflect about her friend, a notable Minneapolis-based musician, Jeremy Messersmith, and how his work illustrates the ways that media shapes narratives and the importance of conversation. Here's that discussion.
My friend and musician, Jeremy Messersmith, really dove into TikTok during the pandemic. And he, you know, got into the creating music with other TikTokers and building community. And he's come to my class, and he used to teach at, I think, McVale in St. Paul. So he's, you know, he's natural in the classroom, but he talked about the impact that TikTok has had on the music community. And it was really fascinating, you know, and the way the, you know, the medium shapes the message, to go back to, you know, Cool McLuhan and Co. company. But he, you know, he talked to us about how, you know, I used to release albums and now I release singles because that's what gets traction. And, you know, some of that's really probably basic and obvious, but it was a really illuminating and fascinating conversation. And TikTok, it connects folks.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of goes back to the roots of, like, right, kind of popular music, right? Like, right, during the radio era, the people tend to release singles because they would get shared on radio, right? People learn about things radio, which I suppose would have been the TikTok of their day.
Yes. I love that.
It's interesting that you brought up Jeremy Messersmith, right? Because Jeremy, for a while there, was doing these, like, right, like, concerts in people's living rooms, right? Like, this very sort of, like,
I've been to a couple.
Yeah. I mean, right, that's an interest, like, it's an interesting instance of, like, kind of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, queering, like, sort of, like, media and communication, right? Like, where you tend to think of, like, right, like, music, musicians, right, the way that people have tended to do music, at least in the last few decades, is sort of, like, big venues or bigger venues, right? Not people's living rooms. Like, you rarely see, like, bands that are, like, post-high school punk bands playing in people's living rooms. But the, right, Jeremy is, right, like, a fairly successful recording artist. And, yeah, for a while there, it was just like, yeah, I'll play shows in people's living rooms. Does he still do that?
Still doing it. Yeah, he just had his schedule for the summer. I tried to snag a slot, but it filled up too fast. But I think, and it's funny, and this is directly connected to our conversation, I think, the reality is that he loves them.
Yeah.
He, you know, he only did it as a creative way. And when he talks about it, he explained, you know, he wanted to not kill people, right? He didn't want to put anybody in danger by bringing them into a closed space. And so over COVID, and he had been doing them before COVID as well. But I think that they became really important to him as a way to have community. And he's still doing them. He loves them. I don't know how much you know about him, but he's a brilliant, really intellectual person. And he puts on, they're really fun and thoughtful and filled with wonderful conversation. I think it's a great outlet for him. And I love this idea, like querying the media sphere, because that connection between interpersonal, connection with people. And that's where I do study the news media and the way that discourse shapes and, you know, our ideas and understanding of what solutions are out there to this huge existential threat to, you know, the planet and our lives. But really, it really does come down to the face-to-face, the interpersonal, you know, having conversations with one another.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, little segue there. And I don't know, I'm going to forget the authors, but there was this book about basically that democracy can't survive outside of the human face-to-face sphere, or it's like asking, can it survive? And of course, that's been written about in the past. And I think it can, but when I was reading, and again, apologies, I don't remember the book, but when I was reading it, it did kind of reinforce this. Oh yeah, we do need to be having conversations with one another, because again, the medium, you know, does impact the message, and it does impact the way that we empathize with one another and the way that we make space for and communicate about things. And so, yeah, it sort of reinvigorated my passion for conversations about climate change. And that's what led me to Catherine Hayhoe and her work, which her book is amazing. And again, I can't believe I can't remember the name of it. Saving the Planet, Saving the World. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember it either. I've been like kind of like when you're talking, like thinking about like what's the title of the book? Yeah, I can't remember it either.
I'm gonna look because this is embarrassing.
But the thing you're thinking, you're saying, right? So you asked a quick question. Saving us. Yes. Yeah. That's right. That's it. So you've been talking about this idea of like, well, so you mentioned this idea about, can we have democracy without like face to face conversation? And it strikes me, right? Like when I'm thinking about that, like, yes, we can, but it's not a very good kind of democracy, right? So like, I think healthy democracy requires us to care about one another, right? Like if we want good outcomes and we want to achieve those outcomes democratically, it requires us generally wanting other folks to do well. We need to have empathy and care for one another, right? To democratically have like come up with policies that are in fact supportive of one another's well-being, right? Like if we right. So like, I mean, I often think a lot of the bad things that currently happen now in politics is because we've started viewing one another's enemies, right? Like, we've lost that inclination or like tendency to care about one another, right? When we have a sense that we're in this together and that like, you know, we need to be thinking about how we support one another. That's when we have laws get made and like rules get made and like systems get created that are supportive of one another's well-being. When we're just trying to own the other side, that's when we end up doing terrible things. I think in some literal sense, yeah, we can have democracy without, you know, that kind of interpersonal relationship, interpersonal contact. But I think it's a very thin and very unhealthy sort of democracy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're so right. And especially, I mean, not that we need to go down too far down the AI rabbit hole, but when we think about, you know, the filter bubbles and when you talked about the division just a moment ago, those, we have to have that empathy for one another. And of course, I'm so sorry to all the people I'm not crediting for my not original ideas, but this idea that we used to be able to, Jaron Lanier, his 10 reasons to quit social media right now. He talks a lot about this idea that we used to be able to understand where people were coming from. You know, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat. Okay. Yeah. I get where you're coming from because we all kind of knew we all watched the same news for the most part. You know, we knew, maybe we didn't watch Fox News, but we knew what was being shown. Maybe we didn't watch MSNBC, but you could tune in and watch it. But now we're in this position where we're so divided, partly because we don't understand the discourse, the narratives that folks are consuming to inform their perspectives, right? And so we're in this spot where we want to have empathy. I want to sit down and I want to listen to you. I want to know why we disagree, right? I love, again, there's a rabbit hole that I could go down about listening and the role it plays in conflict resolution and management. But I want to sit down. I want to talk to you. But when you start saying things to me that I'm like, what? that's not a reality I'm literally not a reality I'm familiar with.
Right.
It's really hard for me to understand. So the investment of time it would take for us to unwind these different, these different narratives, these stories that folks are being told, these quote unquote alternative facts, right? Like we're in this place where how can we get on the same page without a deep patience and a care and and the time to listen? And our lives are so busy. We waste so much time on social media, although it's also wonderful. So that's just a tangent about that role of division.
I think it's an important tangent to think about, right? So I guess maybe a little background for the way I'm thinking about this right now, right? I'm thinking one thing I do appreciate about the way media has become is media now has a lot more space for different perspectives, right? I think back in the day, when we just had broadcast TV and papers are a handful of big papers, the problem with that sort of media was, yes, we all had common ground, but it was also exclusionary, right? There was a particular perspective that's featured. Nowadays, I do think many more people have a voice in media. The problem is those voices are segregated.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then how do you desegregate? This is something I think about in the context of higher ed too. When we're thinking, I've been thinking a lot lately about how do we expand the canon and what does that mean? And then if we're really kind of radically expanding the canon of higher ed and trying to include entirely different traditions of scholarship and inquiry into universities, right? The Western universities. How do we do that? Right. Given that, institutions, have certain sort of conventions and are embedded in particular scholarly histories, right. Think about things in certain ways and frame things in certain ways and engage in certain sorts of projects. When we're kind of trying to integrate these radically different things, how do we do it other than just having a space where we just have all these different segregated conversations? How do we have unified conversations across very fundamentally different perspectives and kind of foundations for thinking about the world.
In the face of human nature, which we don't want to hear things that are contrary to the way that we understand the world naturally, right? And so whatever that segregation looks like has to also be paired with time and intentionality so that we can deal with our cognitive dissonance and we can deal with that discomfort and accept, okay, I'm going to see something different. I'm going to make space for that. I love how you articulated that though, with the alternative canon. Yes, we need space for more ways of knowing and which not to go too far off what you were just talking about, because I'd love to hear more. But that idea of what is scholarship, right? Yeah. As I'm going through, I'm a grad student, I'm a baby. I just finished my first year of my PhD program, and I am staring down the old line. What is my dissertation topic? Well, it's relatively manageable for me to continue the same work I've been doing. I'm interested in it. It's important. It's engaging. Or I could do some action-based, arts-based work that pairs photography and community. And we could, construct our own new narratives about water and water infrastructure. And you write because water is always a part of everything, right? But in the existing academy, in the structure, it's easier to go down the path with ruts in the trail, right? And thankfully, Dr. Mark Pedalty would be an amazing guide down that path if I did want to be brave and do something counter to and different than. But it's an investment and it's a risk and it's, anyway.
No, but I think this is where the thing you said about intentionality matters, right? I think it's being intentional being intentional in so far as recognizing there's those risks and intentionally taking them because it's the right thing to do, right? If it is the right, in your case, the right thing to do, right? Like, I think this is, you have to think about that, right? In the context of like what you're hoping to accomplish, is it the right thing to do? If it is, then right, like being intentional, understanding that it's a risk, and being mindful of it,
and for you as well, right? Like if you're challenging and wanting to add to the canon and and change it, you know, that's important. Excellent work, and you know, approaching it with intentionality is step one, right?
Listening to Marceline discuss the importance of conversation, why we need to be more intentional about how we might converse better, led me to ask her about how she approaches being more intentional when she communicates. Here's what she said in reply. How do you think about that intentionality, right? For you, just, I mean, personally, when you're thinking about like being intentional about changing the ways that we communicate, or like kind of challenging sort of the conventions of how we communicate, or even how yourself, right? Like when you're thinking about as like an individual and a scholar, that's like kind of interestingly, like thinking about and doing at the same time, right? Like how do you approach doing these things more intentionally?
Oh gosh, that's a huge question. It's a lifelong project. And there's so many different angles. I think for me, I'm a I love talking. And so for me, the first thing that I do whenever I'm, you know, trying to cultivate intentionality or approaching something that, I want to learn about, or, you know, whatever it happens to be, is shutting up. Like just listening and seeking out folks who know better than I, who know more than I, who know in a different way, valuing, others' perspectives and experiences as much as my own, you know? So for me, intentionality is a really humbling experience, right? And when, so I've worked in public media, Minnesota Public Radio. And when George Floyd was murdered, the response at our, you know, news organization was to tap into, you know, a version of intentionality, like recognizing our own biases and the role news media plays in, you know, perpetuating systems that enable police brutality and, on and on. And again, this is a tangent, but it's really related. I was introduced to this idea of the white supremacy culture, or the cultural characteristics of white supremacy. And Dr. Tema Okun is the one who wrote this original article on this white supremacy culture. And of course, it was informed by so many people that she worked with. And it's not necessarily, she wouldn't even call it her work, but rather like a outpouring of all of the ways that she, you know, learned about this. And I think it was in the 90s that she wrote the original article. And it basically names these, you know, like all aspects of culture, we are the fish swimming in the water, right? We can't recognize without intentionality. We can't recognize these different values and ways of knowing and being in the world, and the way that they shape every aspect of our lives, including the commodification of nature, right? And so learning about those cultural characteristics, and if you're not familiar, like just a couple of them are like right to comfort, one right way, objectivity, worship of the written word. There's 9 of these characteristics. And she calls them toxic traits. I probably fall more on the like the traits themselves. Some of them, you know, perfection, for example, is one. And yeah, some of them, it's hard to make a case for something like perfection being a good thing, right? But there can be good things that come out of bad things, right? But anywho. So I fall maybe more on the like, well, being aware of these things is the most important thing, right? Being aware of how these values shape the choices we make, and not letting them just be the water we swim in. And so for me, that was an opportunity to really deepen intentionality in a formulaic way, because now I had this list of things. And whenever I started a project, when I was working on a team with folks, I could think to myself, ooh, I feel a sense of urgency. Is that valid?
Right.
Is that something that's been ingrained in me because of, you know, capitalistic, paternalistic, you know?
Right.
Anywho, so that's a really long answer, a really long way of saying that intentionality is, for me, starts with being quiet and listening and valuing perspectives outside of my own. But there's also a lot of work that goes into being intentional. And I don't think that work ever goes away.
Right. Oh, and right. And being mindful of the ways that one is likely to mess up, right? Like, yeah, right, right. Cause I right. So, right. A lot of the folks who talk about overcoming bias, the first step is always just to like recognize that one has biases, right?
Yeah.
That's probably the biggest step. Well, like, one is most likely to be subject or to do things because of bias when one thinks one isn't biased. It's one, yeah, you, right. Just knowing like, wait, I'm coming from this from a particular, you know, kind of cultural, experiential, or like indoctrinated perspective. Is this thing that I'm thinking really just sort of like actually the case, or is it just like sort of the product of, my biases? Always just asking that question helps one be a little bit more mindful. Yeah.
Yeah.
And intentional. Yeah. That's a great answer. Thank you.
How about you? Can you answer that question for, you know, as well? I'd love to hear your perspective.
Yeah. So I just sort of, I think for me, it is the sort of like always, very intentionally reminding myself that, I have biases and I'm not aware of those biases, and those biases are constantly coloring the things I think, right? So like, it's just always acknowledging that whatever I think is probably wrong or at least too narrow, right?
Yeah, I love that.
And so, you know, like, I'm never too confident about the things I think. I always just, you know, I'll venture to like suggest them, but if someone pushes back, I'm very quick to go like, yes, yeah, so you're probably catching something I'm missing. Tell me more.
I love that. Yes.
Yeah.
Same, by the way. Yeah. Yeah.
I think if one always assumes that's one's wrong, it probably helps one to avoid making the most egregious mistakes.
And learning more, right?
Yeah.
When we assume that we're, you know, we've got room to learn and grow.
At this point, our conversation started winding down, and so I ended as I usually do by asking Marceline to take the reins and ask me a question. She took the opportunity to ask me about why I created the Just Sustainability podcast.
Why do you do this podcast, my friend?
Oh, sure. I'm going to tell less of the narrative, the narrative chronological history about it, and more just sort of like the objective I had when I started doing this. So, like, it was really thinking about how I learned, right? So I wanted to create something that was like a toolkit that would be useful for folks to think about like integrating equity and sustainability, right? So like, right, when this project started, like the very roots of the project, like even like prior to recording, like when it was like sort of in the conceptual phase in like 2018 or 2019, I was running across a lot of folks asking me to like participate in projects to create resources for folks thinking about integrating equity and sustainability, because like, you know, that I think that's a thing that's increasingly happening now. And then people who come from like, you know, who are traditional sort of sustainability folks who haven't really thought as much about equity and wanting to integrate it or were looking for tools. And since it was like an area that I worked in for a while, people were asking me. So I was thinking like, what kind of tools would be useful? And then I was thinking, where have I learned the most? And what occurred to me was, the times that I feel like I've learned the most is when I'm at a conference and I run into an old friend, and then we decide to ditch the conference and we either go to a coffee shop or we go out for dinner or we go out for lunch or we go out, you know, to the bar or we go to like, you know, a bookstore and wander around and chat. And then like I ask them like, so what have you been up to? And then they talk about what they've been up to. And then I'm like, oh, go. Because right, like that's, I find like, you know, that's when I get exposed to things that I didn't expect to or didn't directly seek out, right? So, like, I find, like, when I'm engaging in, like, you know, reading about stuff or, like, attending talks, there's the filter of me sort of picking the thing that I'm studying. When I just sort of ask someone to tell me what they've been up to, they tell me what they think is the interesting thing, which is often different from what I would have asked them about, right? Like, if I was asking for a specific thing to tell me about, or like if I was looking for a specific thing to learn about. And so I wanted to capture some of that in whatever tool that I worked on to help folks learn about equity and sustainability. And right, so it was just a podcast where I would just ask open-ended questions to people and then, you know, see where those conversations go.
I love it. Now I want to do like a narrative analysis of all of your podcast episodes.
Yeah, I've been wanting to do that myself. Like, just to think, like, what are some of the themes that have popped up? Because, right, I think I've recorded with, I want to say 20-something people now. I think you're, and then, right, like, so this, right, these episodes that we're recording now, like, this conversation that's going to be made into probably 2 or 3 episodes will be coming out in sometime next academic year. And I think, right, at this point, I have, so you're probably like the 33rd or 34th, maybe 35th person that I've recorded with. Yeah. And so like, right, like there's certainly common themes that have been throughout the, like all of these. And then there's probably some interesting differences. I am kind of curious, right? Like to go through and like code them, like, right. Sometime to go through, code them all and see what are the themes that arise, right? Cause it is starting to get to be a fairly big collection of people just sort of talking generally about their work related to equity and sustainability.
Okay. Well, if you're up for it and you need a friend to help, I'm in.
Yeah. I might take you up on that offer.
And I have appreciated this entire conversation, especially at this, you know, point in my academic career where you're just finding your spot and, you know, looking back on the years of work and how far it's come and considering new paths. It's just wonderful to say things out loud with a, you know, a fellow academic who's interested in similar things. So thank you for this. It's been a gift.
Oh, no. I mean, thank you for taking the time to chat with me. And that brings us to the end of the conversation that I had with Marceline Mosher. During the 90 minutes that we talked, Marceline shared her thoughts about how the dominant narratives about sustainability in the U.S. tend to commodify nature, as well as how we might challenge those narratives through more intentional discourse. Join me in the next episode of Just Sustainability, where I'll introduce you to Valentine Cadu, an associate professor of anthropology and the director of the Center for Justice and Law at Hamline University. Thank you for listening to Just Sustainability. If you've enjoyed what you heard, please support this podcast by subscribing and leaving a review. Just Sustainability is recorded with the support of the Institute and the Environment at the University of Minnesota. In particular, I want to thank Peter Levin and Beth Mercer-Taylor for all their help with this show. All the music on Just Sustainability is composed and recorded by Clifton Nesseth, and all the artwork was created by Kristen Nesseth. Thank you again for listening.